Today we're going to start talking about music of the Baroque period, 1600 to 1750, exemplified by J.S. Bach. Today will be the first of two presentations about the music of Bach, one today dealing with Bach's vocal music, the other coming in sections. Yes, we have sections on Thursday, Friday, and Monday having to do with the instrumental music of J.S. Bach. So we're going to start now with Baroque music and Bach, and a word first about Bach's biography. Bach came from a very long line of musicians. Indeed, 10 generations of Bachs were musicians. Goes back to old Viet Bach in the 16th century and continues generation after generation into the 19th century. In the area in which Bach was born, this small town of Eisenach, you can see the town's name up there and the date in which he was born, 1685. In this area of Thuringia, the region in which Eisenach sits, the word Bach was eponymous. In other words, a Bach simply meant a musician, just like we have the word Kleenex, for example, or we have the word Xerox that begin to take on the connotations of an entire class. So to be a Bach in that area was to be a musician. Johann Sebastian Bach was simply the most talented of this long-lived clan of musicians. From the age of 9, J.S. Bach was orphaned. Both his parents had died by that time, so he was raised for the most part by his older brother, Johann Christoph Bach, who was a student of our Johann Pachelbel. So there is this connection between the Bachs and Pachelbel. And for the most part, J.S. Bach was self-taught. How did he teach himself music? Well, he copied music. He copied music for two reasons. One, to learn the musical style. And two, to get music, because you simply couldn't go to a photocopy machine and copy the music of Corelli or the music of Vivaldi. You had to copy it down yourself by hand. You couldn't go to a music store and buy edited editions because for the most part that didn't exist. So much more of it was simply music copied by one musician after the next. So Bach learned his craft by copying, literally, Corelli, and we have run into Corelli, of course. Anybody remember a piece by Corelli that we performed? Frederick? La Follia, excellent. And he copied Vivaldi. What's Vivaldi's most famous composition? Frederick again. The Four Seasons. So he copied that, and he also copied some other concerti grossi of Vivaldi, oftentimes surreptitiously by moonlight when he was supposed to be in bed. Bach's devotion to his profession was legendary. When he was a young man, he sort of went AWOL from his first job and walked from the town of Arnstadt, which you see up there, walked from Arnstadt in the center part of Germany all the way up to the Hanseatic city of Lübeck on the North Sea up there, a distance of about 250 miles in order to be able to sit at the feet of a very famous organist and composer there in Lübeck. And then he walked back. It would be like one of us wanting to learn something from a congressman or something and walking from New Haven to Washington, D.C. and back. In his day, Bach was legendary, not so much as a composer, oddly enough, but as what? What was Bach known for in his day? We touched on this before. Angela? He was an organist, okay? So he was an organist. He was the great virtuoso organist of central northern Germany in this period. Now, we have met an organ piece of Bach before. What was that? Name, Michael? Mitch, okay, yes. What was that, please? G minor fugue. Can you sing any of it? Could anybody sing any of it? Hey, we got some takers down here, Chris and AJ. Together, a duet, gentlemen, please. Excellent, oh, wow, bravo. Okay. I I think that's sort of the key that they sang it in. We'll come back to that idea in just a minute, because I found myself tripping over that fugue subject in another one that I want to talk about this morning as I was trying to think through these. There's another famous piece, organ piece of Bach that we might have heard recently. Do we have the toccata queued up there? It should be track one. Let's listen to a toccata by Bach written in Arnstadt early in his career. Whoa, where did that come from? That's, oh, I know, it's in the machine. They were in the bay. We lost the CD this morning, so it's sitting in the machine. How interesting. Sometimes our CD player eats our machine for days on end and then only belatedly spits it back out. So do we have that? Okay, we don't have that cued, I'm sorry. But you probably heard it at the concert the other day. Da di 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 di. It's a big organ piece in D minor, kind of spooky music that begins every Halloween show. Well, that's more organ music by J.S. Bach. We may be able to resurrect that after a while. We'll find out. And again, a piece that he composed as a young man here in the town of Arnstadt, roughly 1705 or so. So there he is, first job. We won't say fresh out of college, because Bach did not go to college, but he went to a very high-standing prep school in the northern part of Germany. Just graduated, has his first job at Arnstadt. Let's take a look at Raoul. Here is the picture of our great man, but let's go on to our first real slide there. And I think everybody see that okay? That's the organ in the church at Arnstadt where Bach worked. The organ is still there. The essential parts of the pipes and all are still there. That's the very organ that Bach played. But they've sort of modernized it over the centuries, and they took out the original console. So Raoul, if we could have the next slide, please. And there is the console. This is kind of the central processing unit, if you will, for Bach's organ. So you can see, does that look like a big organ or a small organ to you by our standards? Kind of on the smallest side. There were bigger ones, actually, up to the north. But you can see here, some of you did that extra credit project on the organ, two keyboards and a pedal board down here to be played, obviously, with the feet. And what do you suppose these things are working all around it? What would we call those? We're going to pull one of those. A stop, okay? And it brings into play an extra rank of pipes of a particular sound. And we have this expression, oh, I'm going to pull out all the stops. Well, of course, that has to do with organ technology. So this is Bach's, the console, in effect, of Bach's original organ. Bach eventually left Arnstadt and moved on to the larger city of Weimar, where he stayed, as you can see there, from 1708 to 1717. 1717. And he functioned as an organist and a court musician there. In 1717, he decided to leave that position in Weimar and move on to another town, Curten. And the Duke of Weimar, Duke Wilhelm, summarily had Bach thrown in jail. Bach was thrown in jail for a month. Sat in jail, languished in jail. We think he started the well-tempered clavier while in jail. Why did the Duke have Bach thrown in jail? Any ideas? Well, he hadn't obtained a release from the Duke. And this tells us something about the status of musicians in the 18th century. They were little better than indentured servants. No such thing as free agency here, not like baseball players or whatever today. If you wanted to take another position, you had to get your present employer to say, okay, it's all right if you go. Imagine that today. You want to quit your job and move on to a better job. Well, you can't leave until the present boss says you can go. But that was the case, and Bach had violated that modus operandi, and there he languished in jail for a month. Finally, the Duke of Weimar relented, and off Bach and his family went to the town of Curten. Let's take a look at the next slide, please, the town of Curten. Again, sort of central Germany. This is an engraving of the mid-17th century, and we can see here the court building of complex plexus where Bach worked there in the center. Now we're going to go to the front of that next slide as it stands today. It's rather heavily damaged after communist occupation after World War II. Rather not in the best state of repair. You go inside the courtyard there. Next slide, please. Going in, you can see it's something of a mess because they are fixing up that room and indeed have fixed up that room up above. Let's have the next slide, please. And here is that room up above, the so-called now crystal room of the palace at Curtin. And this was where Bach performed. And when you go to sections this week, you will watch a wonderful video of a performance of the Bach Brandenburg Concerto No. 5 performed right in this hall. You'll see those same windows there. This is Bach's music performed in the environment for which Bach had created it. In 1723, Bach moved again. He was an aggressive, ambitious person, J.S. Bach. He moved this time to the city of Leipzig. Leipzig, a little bit to the south of Curtin, and he spent the rest of his career in Leipzig. He moved to Leipzig in 1723 for two reasons. And we'll come back to those two reasons. But while I have this slide up here, let's just put this in context a little bit. You can see where Berlin is there. You can see where Lübeck is, where he walked all the way at the top. This is central Germany here. And these towns aren't too far apart. Here's Curtin. Here's Leipzig. So 1723, he goes to Leipzig. And he goes there for two reasons. One, next slide. One, because his family will be given, by the standards of the time, rather large quarters here. Actually, by our standards, they were very small, 900 square feet. Bach ultimately had 20 children, and they were living in 900 square feet. Ask yourself, do you know how many square feet are in your parents' apartment or home? A lot more than 900. But this was thought to be big digs back in the 18th century in these cities that were encased by military fortresses. In any event, we can see Bach's working area and living area right here in this building. And I want you to count the number of stories because it will become important later on. One, two, three, and then the roof begins. And I also want you to, it's hard to see on the slide, but there's a group of choir boys walking out here. How do I know they're choir boys? Because they're arranged by height. Ever look at choir boys? That's how they arrange them when they walk in procession. The young kids first, the older ones toward the back. We'll come back to that point in just a minute. Another reason Bach moved to Leipzig was it was a university town, so he could get a free university education for his numerous sons. What about his numerous daughters? Did they get a free education at the university? No, because women did not go to the university in this period. The first woman to receive a degree, a college degree in a Western university, was a woman enrolled in philosophy at the University of Padua in 1676. So it would be unprecedented, really. I mean, there was one precedent. In Bach's day for women to go to university. It was assumed that just the men would go to university. In any event, let's talk about Bach's standing here in the town of Leipzig. Bach had to petition for this job. He wanted this job because it had these advantages, as mentioned. And he was not the first choice of the town council of Leipzig. There was another composer who was their first choice, Georg Philipp Telemann. He declined the position. They offered it to somebody else named Graupner. He couldn't get a release from his employer, so he couldn't take it. And so as the town minutes of the town council say, since good musicians can't be had, mediocre ones will have to suffice. And they turn at that point to Bach. Which I guess calls us to ask, how many misjudgments are we making in our lives? Maybe AJ doesn't realize that sitting right next to him, Chris there, is really a genius, and we should pay more attention. How many geniuses are sort of sneaking around in our midst unrecognized today? Anyway, Bach was anything other than the grand artiste when he arrived in Leipzig. Here I've made some Xeroxes out of my book called The Bach Reader. When Bach got there, he had to take an oath of office. He had to swear to do the following. One, I shall set the boys a shining example of honest and retiring manner of life, serve the school industriously, and instruct the boys conscientiously. Two, bring the music on all the principal churches of the town into good estate, to the best of my ability. Three, show the honorable and most wise counsel all proper respect and obedience. And so on it goes. Here are a few more things. Faithfully instruct the boys, not only in vocal music, but also in instrumental music. And he had to teach them Latin as well. Arrange the music that it shall not last too long. Ah. And shall be of such a nature as not to make an operatic impression, but rather incite the listeners to devotion. So they didn't want Bach's music to go on too long, which is very important. And they didn't want it to be very operatic. They wanted sort of conservative music there. Here's number 12, not to go out of town without the permission of the Honorable Burgermeister. Number 13, always walk as far as possible with the boys at funerals. So Bach here in Leipzig is sort of a glorified scoutmaster. He's not this kind of 19th century image of the genius or of the grand artiste, as mentioned. Okay, the point being, once again, that Bach in his day was recognized and valued not so much as a composer, but as a performer. Well, what was the matter with Bach's music? Why did they already at the outset here sort of clipping his wings, telling him what style not to write in? Well, Bach had this proclivity for writing music that's very sort of rigid, very chromatic, very contrapuntal, and very long. And it is long and contrapuntal, as we will be seeing in particular in sections this coming week. If we compare, for example, to Concerti Grossi, the first movement of Vivaldi's Spring Concerto, it lasts 3 minutes and 10 seconds. Bach writes a first movement of a Concerto Grosso. You're going to watch a video of it. It runs for 9 minutes and 10 seconds. So it's three times as long, three times as dense in a way. Let's go on to talk about the kinds of things that Bach composed here. And for that, we'll take a look at the board. Bach's works. Some of these we've talked about already. Preludes and fugues for harpsichord or keyboard, the well-tempered clavier. We've talked about the G minor organ fugue. We can talk about the art of the fugue. Let's have the next slide. I think I've got a slide of that here. No, wrong piece. Okay, sorry. This is the Bach Brandenburg. I brought in the wrong slide. I'm sorry. But the Art of Fugue is an interesting composition that Bach wrote very much toward the end of his life. Sonatas for flutes and violin, viola. Dance suites for orchestra. You may know the air on a G string. Beautiful, beautiful solo violin writing there with basso continuo underneath. Solo concertos for violin and harpsichord. Concerti Grossi that we'll be talking about, the Brandenburg Concertos, will be working with number 5. Then he wrote a lot of religious vocal music, the B minor Mass. I was playing parts of the Sanctus of the B minor Mass when we came in. Linda, this is going to really mess things up. Do we know where we have that Sanctus, where the Bach B minor Mass is? It's track 10, if you can get to the CD. Let's just listen to a little bit of, this is on the fly this morning, but let's just listen to a bit of the Sanctus of the B minor Mass to give you a sense of the monumental quality that Bach can create.
Sanctus, 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 Sanctus,
So pretty impressive stuff, but it goes on for a long time, and it's filled with imitation and fugal subjects that recombine, and different kinds of permutations can be inverted and go backwards and forwards and upside down. And this is what Bach would do. If somebody would write a set of variations that had 10 variations in it, he would write a set of variations with 20 variations in it. If somebody would write one canon, he would write 10 canons, as he does, for example, in the Goldberg variations. Whatever he did, he sort of prosecuted maniacally, and what he ended up with was stuff that's very dense, very compact, is really the best sort of craftsmanship, but it's not necessarily the most sort of popular music in that regard. But as you heard, it can be very grand and quite spectacular, as we heard from the Sanctus of the B minor Mass there. When Bach arrived in Leipzig, it was a town of 35,000 and was one of the biggest in Germany. Does that sound like a big town to you, 35,000? No. I mean, Hamden probably has 35,000 people living in it. But this was a big city in Bach's day. He was called there to run music for all of the Lutheran churches in that town. Now, we're talking here Leipzig, which is not far from Wittenberg, where Martin Luther was active. So we're talking about kind of the home ground of Lutheranism here. And Leipzig enjoyed complete freedom of religion. You could attend any church, according to this was all Christianity, you could attend any church that you wished. Any church that you wished. There were a dozen or so of them in this city. The only kicker was that they were all Lutheran churches. You'd go to this Lutheran church or that Lutheran church, whatever one you want, but they were all Lutheran churches. So Bach's job was to organize the music for these churches, particularly the principal church, which was this St. Thomas Church. And what he wrote for this St. Thomas Church was this thing called the cantata. What's a cantata? Well, literally, it's a sung thing as opposed to a sonata, sounded thing. So this is a sung thing. What can we say about the cantatas that Bach wrote? How would we summarize them? Well, they are multi-movements, recitative, aria, chorus, multi-movements. They go on for about 25 to 30 minutes. They are religious in subject matter. And of course, they are written in the German language. And Bach wrote about 300 of these cantatas. He wrote them in cycles of 50. When he arrived there in 1723, he starts writing one cantata for each Sunday. At the end of the year, he's got about 50 of these things. Next year, he starts all over again. So he ended up with about 300 cantatas. Then he got exhausted from the process and stopped about 1729, 1730 or so. Now, on the board up here, you see the layout of a typical cantata. It is Wachet auf, ruh uns die Stimme, arise, a voice is calling. And here's I hope you can see this okay, here's how it shakes down. We have seven movements in this cantata, seven movements. And they are arranged chorus, then recitative. What's a recitative? Somebody tell us what a recitative is. We haven't talked about it, but maybe you know from other context. Jacob? Yeah, okay. It's not much music, more sort of spoken dialogue, accompanied a little bit by a basso continuo. A basso continuo. Anybody tell me from the reading what a basso continuo is? Well, I think if you look on your text in about page 114, you'll find a discussion of it. But a basso continuo is an ensemble that plays a bass line. And because a number of instruments are involved in it, be the left hand of the harpsichord, maybe a cello, maybe also a bassoon, two, three instruments playing a bass line, it makes for a very heavy, very powerful bass line. And this is something that is typical of Baroque music. So a recitative will be accompanied, and indeed all the arias will be accompanied by basso continuo, the choral stuff will be accompanied by basso continuo. Continuum is just always going. So it's a strong bass that's always going. It's different from the basso ostinato, because what happens in a basso ostinato? Young? It keeps repeating over and over and over again. So a basso ostinato would be a particular kind of basso continuo, a kind of species of basso continuo. But basso continuo, a bass that's always going on and is very strong. So we'd have sort of spoken dialogue with a strong bass, then an aria. And I'm going to say something about these arias in this period. They are da capo arias in the Baroque period. What does a da capo aria mean? Anybody peeked ahead at that or in discussions in around pages 150, 160 or so in the text, or know that from other contexts? What would a da capo aria be? Well, literally, da capo, you know, sounds like a film score, the capo or something. It means the head guy, or in this case, the beginning of the music, the head of the music. It means you take it from the beginning of the music. So you do one section, an A section, and then you have a contrasting section, and then you get this sign that says DC, da capo, and then you go back and do the A section all over again. So what form do we end up with when we have a da capo aria then, obviously? Ternary form, okay? So the arias in here are usually structured in the Baroque period in a da capo form. And then we have the choruses, chorus 1, chorus 4, chorus 7. And in each of these choruses, we are making use of this thing called a chorale tune, a chorale tune. What's a chorale? What's a chorale tune? Well, chorale tune is just what other Christian denominations would call a hymn, or what we hear at Yale. Whether we're Muslim, whether we're Jewish, or whether we're Christian, we're going to have to sing D. And so on it goes. I think it's called Duke Street, O God Beneath the... Oh God, above thy rising stars, thy exiled fathers cross the sea. It was actually written here in New Haven, so it's kind of the Yale hymn, if you will, or maybe the Yale chorale. So these chorales were sort of old melodies, old religious melodies. Some of them were sort of remakes of Gregorian chants. The Lutherans just took old Catholic chants and turned them into chorale tunes. Others were newly composed, going all the way back to the 16th century. Martin Luther himself composed chorale tunes. Anybody name a chorale tune or a hymn tune of Martin Luther? I bet you've... Da 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 bum 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 ba ba bum bum. Anybody know the name of that? Yes, Kristen, is it? Okay, nice and loud, please, Kristen. Okay, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. It's a Reformation, so the Reformation chorale, and musicians have used that frequently over the centuries. So we're not going to be working with A Mighty Fortress. We're going to be working with a different chorale tune, Wachet auf, ruht uns die Stimme, which was a couple of years old by the time Bach got his hands on it. And you have it here. So on your sheet, everybody got the sheet for today? Maybe I'll turn the lights back on just for a moment, see a little better. Yeah, that's a little better. Oh, that's even more. So here is a chorale tune, and it's in lots of phrases, right? What about this? Do you think that's a tonal melody? Does that sound pretty secure for you, or does that sound sort of weird? Roger, what do you think? Sounds secure. It is tonal, and why would you imagine it sounds secure? If you look at the downbeat of each measure, almost every measure, what notes do we have there? They're notes that form a triad, a major triad. So we mustn't forget all that stuff we studied early on. So here's Bach, or borrowing a chorale tune that is foregrounding a major triad in a big way. And who has to sing this? Well, ultimately, the full congregation. Everybody has to sing these chorale tunes to show that you are, in this case, a good Lutheran, I suppose. So everybody was be expected to sing them, and because of that, they tended to be rather stepwise. So we should all sing this, right? Today we're all going to be good Lutherans, no matter what our real religion is, assuming we have a real religion. So let's start here, and we're just going to sing La. Here we go. La 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 la. Okay, great. Now this is not working so well. And why is it not working so well? It's too high. So what would Bach have done in those days? The only person here that can sing this is Linda and Santana, because they're sopranos, and I could hear them. But that was about all I could hear. It's too high. So what would they have done in Bach's day? Stop singing it? I don't know, lightning bolts would come down on the church or something. I'm not quite sure. No, they couldn't stop singing it. They had to transpose it. Just take it down. We'll make it lower. So instead of being... Let's go... We'll go to a different key. Here we go. Ready, sing. La 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 la. Rest. La 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 la. Louder. La 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 la. Okay, we'll stop there. We'll stop there. So Bach's got this chorale, and then he's going to do something with it. And what he does is write a first movement. So that takes us back over here to movement one of our chorale. We're going to talk now about the text with regard to this particular chorale. What's the text calling about? Well, here's the translation of it. Awake, a voice is calling from the watchman from high in the tower. Awake, Jerusalem, midnight is the hour. They call us with a clarion voice. Where are the wise virgins? Get up, the bridegroom cometh. Stand up and take your lamps. Alleluia, provide yourself for the wedding. You must go forth to meet him. Now, in Bach's day, this chorale would have been sung. It's the major musical portion of the cantata, which is the major musical portion of the whole service, which was sung right after the reading of the gospel. So they'd come in and there'd be some introductory chorales and prayers and that kind of thing. Then they would have a reading of the gospel, the thesis of the day. Now, this particular cantata is written for Advent. So what's Advent? Who can tell me what Advent is? Don't necessarily have, you know, Muslim, Jew, Christian, whatever, you may probably know what Advent is. That is? It's the days before Christmas. So we have the English word adventitious, something coming, something about to arrive. It's the birth of Christ in this particular case. So it's, I think, roughly the 4 weeks before Christmas, think maybe late November, early December, up to Christmas. So that's when this cantata would have been appropriate. It would have been sung, say, on the Sunday, the 1st of December, something like that. And as I say, it's preceded by the gospel of the day. So to get our heads in this, we have to understand what Bach's message is here. We have to know what the gospel is. So I've asked Chris, I gave Chris the textbook here. I put the textbook in there. I asked Chris to read the gospel for today. So stand up you're going to stand up?
Then shall the kingdom of heaven.
Oh, good. I like that. Nice and loud. The voice of God.
Unto 10 virgins, which took their lamps and went forth to meet the bridegroom. And 5 of them were wise, and 5 were foolish. They that were foolish took their lamps, but took no oil. And at midnight, there was a cry made, Behold, the bridegroom cometh. Go ye out to meet him. Then all those virgins arose, and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said unto the wise, Give us of your oil, for our lamps are gone out. But the wise answered, saying, Not so, lest there be not enough for us, any. But go ye rather to them that sell, and buy for yourselves. And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and they that were ready went in with him to the marriage, and the door was shut. Watch therefore, for ye know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man.
Okay, excellent. And that's the King James version of that. So the syntax is sometimes difficult and the verbiage is a little bit unexpected there. But what does all this mean? What is this? Roger? The second coming of Christ, okay. And what are we supposed to do? We, good citizens of Leipzig, what are we supposed to do? Be ready, get our spiritual house in order because Christ is coming. So Bach has this idea of this powerful figure coming into the midst of Leipzig. And he creates the following kind of music. We start out here with dum da dum da dum da dum da dum da dum da dum, and then it begins to move a little bit in pitch. It's a good example of something that we'll talk about in a moment. But if we want to have the sense of the inexorable march of something, what better way than a repeating bass line? Then we have a melody begin. And then we didn't have time. We have a C motive that we want to put up here. So when you read your textbook there, I interpreted this as follows. You will hear someone saying, i.e. me saying, that this is the inexorable march of the Lord coming to the citizens of Leipzig. They get very excited and begin to run in his direction. This is the, Bach didn't write all this down. I'm kind of interpreting it this way. But I can't help but think back on the early session that we had talking about the musical Chicago and that that number in Chicago, get the gun, the gun, the dee, 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 and it gets faster and faster and the texture gets denser and denser. Well, that's exactly what Bach is doing here. Whether it's Broadway or Bach, the modus operandi is going to be the same. So let's listen to just a little bit here. This is the opening movement of Bach's cantata, Wacket auf, ruh uns die Stimme. Stop it there. That's just the opening phrase. And the crowd's coming in with little fugal expositions underneath that. Who, where, coming where, sort of this busy counterpoint underneath. I used to use this as a listening exercise, but it didn't work. It was too, the students couldn't respond. I don't know, it just was too complex. And then the way it told me something, Bach's music is very, very complex. So I went on to a more straightforward movement, and that's what we're going to do now. The fourth movement that incorporates the chorale. So we have the chorale sort of like the voice of God up here on top. Let's go on to the fourth movement that you may well recognize as one of Bach's most famous compositions. And I have three questions for you here. What's the bass doing? How many voices are there? How many line strands do you hear in the texture? And where is the chorale tune? Who's singing the chorale tune? So this is movement 4 of Cantata Wacket auf. Thank you. then the ritornello starts again. This refrain theme starts all over again. All right, let's pause it there. So what kind of bass do we have here? Dum, dum, dum. It's called walking bass, right? We've talked about that before. And once again, it gives a very sort of secure foundation. So we have a basso continuo playing a walking bass. Boom, 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 boom. Something like that, just going on and on, sort of with the same note values. Tends to be stepwise, have the same note values. What else did we need to know there? What happened to the chorale? Well, first of all, well, what about the texture? How many strands did you hear in that texture? Brian and Nicole, you want to huddle out there and figure out what the answer to this one is? What do you think? Nicole, how many strands? How many lines did you hear there? Okay, well, we've got the bass in there, and we had that lovely, lovely melody, dee-da-da-dum-pa-dee-pa-dee-pa, which you have on your sheet there. So that's two, and what was the third one? Well, the chorale tune, ya-pa-pa-dee-pa-dee-pa. But what was different about the chorale tune this time? It was easier to hear. Why? Because all of the male voices were singing it together in unison. It wasn't distributed in all this counterpoint in all of the voices. All the voices were singing it together. And if you have this sheet here, I think the miracle of this particular sheet is that this guy thought had this one melody, ya-ti-pom, and he said, gee whiz, you know, if I went ya-ti-pom-ba-di-di-dum-ba-dum-be-da-be-da-be, I could have that go against this melody. He thought he had one nice melody, and he thought up an even more beautiful melody that could interweave with his given melody. So that's the gift here, to be able to hear one thing and size up its implications, to know what it could become. I guess that's what a great creative artist is all about, to know what something can become. All right, so we have that particular movement, and I think that's the basis of your listening exercise 22 for next time. Now, we're getting toward the end of our hour, and I want to ask you, we're going to do two more things. One, we're going to come back at the end to the end of the cantata. But I want to ask you a question about, and just try to put yourself in Bach's shoes here for the moment. You got this job as a composer, and you got to generate all this music, right? You got to generate 25 to 30 minutes of new music every week. Well, that would be like, all right, so presumably you get Sunday afternoon off, watch football, whatever you want to do. Then Monday morning, you start all over again. And by next Sunday morning, you got to have 25 to 30 minutes of music ready to perform. Why is that really hard? What's the hard part of this? What's the time-consuming part of all of this? I see Roger and Elizabeth. Elizabeth, go with it. Writing it out, yeah. Probably not composing it. I think these composers just have this stuff spewing out of their ears nonstop. I don't think it was thinking it up, and maybe not rehearsing it, though that would take some time. But before the days of copyist machines, it would be very laborious to copy the full score and all of these parts, maybe 14 different lines simultaneously, and multiple copies of the violin parts and the cello parts and this kind of thing. So it would be very time-consuming. How did he do this? Well, let's see if we can go back to the next slide here, and we're going to talk about this just for a bit. How did Bach execute this? And the next, Raul, I think there was so we're going to go back into our church here, and we're going to see Bach's church where his the floor plan here, and then we're going to, next slide, please, take a look at the inside of it where the sermon was preached, and take a note of the high altar up there. Next slide. We're going to go through these quickly now. There we have the west end up there where the organ is. That's where the cantata would be performed. Next slide. The organ up there. Here's a question for you. Is this an organ from Bach's day? Next slide. That looked like Bach's organ? Nah, too many mechanical mechanical contrivances there. So that's an organ from the beginning of the 20th century. And box organ would have looked far more like this, and we're going to talk about this in section a little bit later on. Moving on, let's go back to this, because this is the building that we saw before, the place where Bach lived. If we look at it now and start counting up, we see that now there are five stories before we reach the roof line. In 1731, Bach petitioned the town council, because of his large family, to take the roof off of this building and provide him with more space. More space because he had all of these children, he had relatives, and he had students living in these quarters. And what did they do to earn their keep? Well, they copied music for him. So this is sort of, if you will, the corporate headquarters of Bach, Inc. This is where all this great music is being generated from. His wife, Anna Magdalena Bach, was his principal copyist. All right, so that's where they live. Now, Bach, of course, as mentioned, died in 1750. Historians are profoundly grateful to him for that, because it gives us a nice, clean cutoff by which to end the Baroque era, end of Bach, end of Baroque. Died in 1750 of a stroke at age 65. At the time, he wasn't thought to be particularly important, so they relegated Bach's remains to an outlying parish church. As Mozart played Bach, Beethoven played Bach, Felix Mendelssohn played Bach, people began to realize that, lo and behold, they'd had a genius in their midst. So they exhume Bach to see if he was a genius. Let's take a look at this. This is what they did in 1895. They dug him up and they photographed him, because this was the period in which there was a theory of genius. Interestingly enough, that the genius had a smaller brain than the normal human being. Not a larger brain, but a smaller brain. In any event, Bach's brain turned out to be just completely normal, and this was presumably a lot of nonsense. But when they dug him up, then they repositioned him, and they repositioned him at the high altar. And this marker here is now where the remains of Bach are situated, and they tore out the south side bank of glass in the church and constructed, based on the photograph that you saw at the beginning of our hour, that photograph, they constructed stained glass windows with titles of some of Bach's works there, so that the musical tourists such as myself, or I hope you someday, will go to Leipzig to enjoy the wonderful music of this city and the wonderful music of Bach. Now, the last thing we're going to do on our way out, the way the cantata would end, is that the entire congregation would stand up and everybody together would sing the chorale tune. We're not going to do that because you already did that. But we'll just play this music as you go out to give you a sense of how the service would end.